Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hello, I'm Mark Goodyear. Welcome to this special edition of the Classic Album Club podcast. In this episode, Phil Alexander will host a roundtable discussion of the music and legacy of one of the greatest rock bands in the world, Led Zeppelin. He'll be joined by Dave Brolin, editor of the book Led Zeppelin by Led Zeppelin, journalist and author Mark Blake, and Deborah Bonham, sister of legendary drummer John Bonham.
Deborah, let's start with you, because one of the things that's happened this year is the unveiling of a permanent memorial to John in Redditch. It's a gigantic 2.5-tonne statue created by Mark Richards. Mm-hmm. It was unveiled in May on what would have been John's 70th birthday. Tell us how that came about.
It started with a couple of fans in Redditch that really felt it was time that Redditch had something to, you know, acknowledge the achievements of their famous son, I guess. And they started a group to try to fundraise. And I sort of watched this happening, and I could see they were struggling a bit. It, you know, they didn't quite know how to make it happen. So I got involved. And anyway, cut a long story short, I managed to raise the money and double what we needed. I approached Mark Richards, really amazing sculptor. I just knew when we sort of met that this was going to be it. We had an idea of how we wanted it to look. The essence of John was the energy of him playing the drums, you know. So we had to find something that would portray that. So we found this photograph, which is an iconic photograph that we used, and Mark interpreted it absolutely amazingly. And so that's how it sort of came about. And, you know, I just thought it was really fitting for his 70th birthday. And the remainders of the money, we have linked in with Teenage Cancer Trust. We've set up Teenage Cancer Trust West Midlands with Teenage Cancer Trust in John's name. And that will continue to raise money for them. But we gave them a large donation, and that will help, you know, help kids with cancer throughout that area, including the Redditch area. So, yeah, that's what's happened.
Well, it's marvellous stuff. And I have to say, I mean, it really is an impressive... it looks gigantic, and it was unveiled at night as well, wasn't it? It was literally... I mean, just tell me why, because it's...
Well, you know Led Zeppelin. There's always a circus around Led Zeppelin. you know, and that's good, but it would become... I felt, and I was working with a very dear friend of mine, and I wanted him to be there. And I wanted it to be about John more than it become about, well, are Led Zeppelin reforming? Oh, all the guys have got together. Or is this a reformation? You know, stuff. Inevitably, that's what would have happened. And our John was quite an unassuming guy in private. I mean, I know... He got the name of being relatively, or let's say more than relatively raucous on tour. but you know, he was very unassuming for a lot of his friends that knew him. And there was always the mystique about Led Zeppelin as well, you know.
Of course.
And I just felt that if we just let this appear in the night, I mean, you know, there was a few of us there to make sure it was done. And we had a little toast of champagne But I thought if we just do that and it just appears, there's none of that pomp and there's none of that, it suddenly becomes all about Led Zeppelin. This was really about John.
Yeah,
So that's why we did it that way. And then, of course, this week we've had the official event. We waited until September to do the official event for the town, you know. So that worked out really well.
No, I mean, I applaud you for all of it, really. Now, obviously, John's voice is sadly missing from the band's official book, Led Zeppelin by Led Zeppelin, but Dave Brolin, all the other three band members have contributed to the book with a set of annotations, which sort of sit at the back of the book, because it's photographed throughout most of it, but there's 20 pages of really fantastic annotations that kind of relive their experience through the band. Can you explain how the idea of the book came about, and also how the process worked when it came to collating the thoughts of Jimmy Robert and John Paul Jones?
The book came about, I'd worked with them on all the reissue albums that had books, and it became clear there's a never-ending stream of Zeppelin books, and it seemed like a good idea that the band would put together one that they were happy with, that they had some involvement with. And I would hear comments that they were never asked about any of the books that were produced. And so we suggested it, and they said yes, and we had a rough outline of the framework existed because they'd already chosen pictures that they liked for the various projects. And then we just put them all together and filled in the gaps and let them choose, really. And they supplied all the pictures they had as well, from both the band, their own archive and personal pictures, and the record company. They each had an idea of how they would like a book to be. Robert very much wanted it to show what it was like for them in all aspects. And Jimmy wanted to show the sort of dynamics of the performances through the years, and the sort of rapid growth, which I think the first part of the book is really quite, it's one of the biggest parts, because there's so many changes, and you see them playing in a pub one day and in a big arena the next, and then back to a pub. And, you know, for the first few years it was like that. And John Paul Jones, you know, very much was about the rhythm section being well represented, because just the nature of rock photography back then was, the focus was on the front man. And we managed to, I think, tick all the boxes. And when it came to the annotations, we just sat and talked like a conversation. And the idea was that rather than try and tell the history or contradict previous tellings of it, was to just look at the pictures and whatever that sparked off. Sometimes it was directly about the image, and other times it was just a recollection from that period. And what was lovely is how John Bonham was very present in all the conversations and the picture choice. Mm-hmm. And it really was, I felt quite privileged to be involved in that side of things. And we did get a quote. We looked through the various interviews, and at the end of his piece that we've quoted from, he said, he's talking about the early days. Each of the band members at the beginning of the book wrote a piece about how they felt when they'd just got together. They had no idea what was going to come and what that felt like. And we found a quote from John, which sort of perfectly summed it up. And he said, I don't think I had any idea the group was going to achieve what it did. You could tell it was going to be a good group, you know, not to be flash about it, but I am. And it just seemed, you know, and from the others as well, they seemed really proud of what they'd done, and they should be flash about
it. Yeah.
Well, I agree. I mean, we'll come on to discuss exactly how things have, why the legacy is so important and how their music continues to resonate in a short while. But obviously, among the hundreds of shots in the book, the band's manager, Peter Grant, of course, features as well. And Mark Blake, you've been working on a book with the Grant family, which is out on October the 25th. Let's discuss Peter's role in the Led Zeppelin story, because you do sense that without his involvement, things may have been slightly different.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, he got them paid a lot in cash, in bags of cash. He looked after them, and I think he had 10 years on the road himself as a road manager and a bouncer and so on, driving other groups around, Chuck Berry, Gene Vincent, Mike and Bernie Winters he started with as well.
Match.
You can't forget them. And I think he brought 10 years' worth of experience to the band. You know, and that was his thing. He'd worked with Don Arden, who wasn't entirely honest with his artists. And his idea was, if you look after the artist, everything else will follow. If you look after them, let them do the music, let me take care of everything else. And if they can concentrate on the music, then, you know, you could have potentially have huge success with this.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose he favoured what is known as an artist-first approach, which in this day and age sounds very normal. But to be really fair, that is very revolutionary in itself for that particular period of time, for
absolutely.
The late 60s.
Absolutely.
You know, there's no doubt about that. We'll come on, Mark, and talk a bit more about the kind of revolution instigated by Peter as far as the business side is concerned with Led Zeppelin later on. But, of course, he accompanied Jimmy Page to New York when the band had completed their first album, and between them they secured a deal like no other with Atlantic Records. And we should point out that that first self-titled album also sounded like nothing else when it was released in the UK on January the 12th, 1969, and 2 months later in America. And that kind of brings us on to a discussion of some of the more specific aspects of the Led Zeppelin legacy. And as well as our live guests, you'll be hearing from some other famous fans as we go along. The first theme we're going to discuss is the first time you heard Led Zeppelin. And here, with his memory of that, from Thin Lizzy and now Black Star Riders, is Scott Gorham.
The first time I remember Led Zeppelin, I think I was 17 years old, and sitting outside in a car outside of one of my friend's house in Glendale, California, and this song came on, this riff. I thought, oh my God, who's that? That sounds amazing. That sounds incredible. Every part of that song I was hooked on.
Interesting stuff there from Scott. And obviously that leads me on to a very simple question, which I'd like to ask you all, starting with you, Deborah. And it's an odd one, really, because obviously you grew up around John. But when was the first time you heard Led Zeppelin? And what did you think of it at the time when you first heard them?
The first time I actually heard Led Zeppelin was when I went to see them. I heard the record first of all, so I must have been about six or seven, and you know, it was my big brother's. But apart from that, I used to have all my little friends come round, and we'd have Dazed and Confused on, and I used to make them dance like crazy when the guitar really got going.
Impressive stuff.
You know, yeah. Well, you know, I think I had the startings of Led Zeppelin play at my sixth birthday party. You know, because John and Robert played, and I vaguely remember somebody telling me that Jimmy turned up. So you know, it was quite a hip party I had when I was six. But I then went to see them again at the Birmingham Odeon, which was such a great place. They played the Town Hall and the Odeon, and I guess I was getting to about eight or so then. I think they got Led Zeppelin 2 out, and it just blew me away. And it really, then I thought, I want to do this. I want to do this. And I've spent the rest of my life trying. It wasn't as easy as I thought it was going to be, let me tell you. But it just blew me away. And, you know, as I've grown older, I mean, I've lived with Led Zeppelin as a staple in my diet, and there's probably not many days that go by where I don't play some Led Zeppelin. I know that sounds cheesy, but you know, I play it a lot because sometimes I just get blown away by it, and I just think, bloody hell, how?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's phenomenal stuff.
And specifically as well with your brother, very much as the engine room, you know, the driving force, without a shadow of a doubt. You know, that's the thing.
Yeah.
I mean, not to disparage anybody else. I mean, it is the four
that
created this, but it is
absolutely
that thing that, you know, he obviously has that power, which I think all the other three guys do talk about in real reverential terms, you know.
Without a doubt, but I mean, also with that power, he could restrain it as well, and there would be a lot of jazz Motown influences in his playing as well,
yes,
which sort of brought me really into listening to a lot of those artists, you know, and their drummers, and sort of really, it was for me, it's always been about the soul that Led Zeppelin brought,
yes, yeah, yeah,
you know. In their style of music, It was incredibly soulful. Everyone was playing from the heart. So, you know, that was a real big trigger for me. Even it got me as an 8-year-old, as a 6-year-old even. It got me straight into my core, you know.
Yeah.
And that's a hard thing to live up to, you know, when you decide to then go into the music industry yourself, which I did. I really wished I'd had a manager like Peter Grant, I can tell you.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think he was such a staunch ally, you know, that's the main thing, really.
And especially back then, you know, with what was going on, you know, in the music world. It isn't that different now, to be honest. It's just done corporately now.
Yeah, less mobsters around, unfortunately. But let's move on rather diplomatically there. And Mark,
yes,
you and I both grew up really as Led Zeppelin's career was effectively coming to an end.
Yeah.
So we kind of have very different memories from the memories that you know Deborah has in terms of age and all that kind of stuff, in terms of seeing a band so young and all the rest of it. And of course, we weren't related to any of them as well. But do you remember the first time you heard Led Zeppelin?
Well, it would have been probably the Top of the Pops theme, I guess, in some ways. I knew that. But I remember, and I was thinking about this earlier, is that when Physical Graffiti came out, I would have been about 10. And then I think it was when I was about 11, his older brother had a copy and they played me Kashmir. And I would have been about 10 at the time, maybe 11, and I couldn't take it in. It was like I couldn't make sense of it because it was so unlike anything I'd heard before. I think I found it quite intimidating, actually. I couldn't get over Robert Plant's voice, which to me was unlike anything I'd heard before. And probably that drum sound and that sort of that huge orchestral thing, because there were no points of reference in pop music. If I was listening to Mud or Slade or Sweet or whatever was in the charts around that time, this was so removed from that. And I kind of didn't go back to it again for another couple of years, and then it started to make sense. But it was actually, it wasn't Physical Graffiti, it was just the one song, Kashmir. By the end of it, I felt sort of slightly exhausted, which I think is a great thing. You know, that's for music to have that impact on you is incredible, you know, and I still look back to that now. I still, when I hear it now, or things like In My Time of Dying, I have to sort of brace myself. It's powerful stuff.
No, I mean, I agree with you. I mean, that sense of being completely overwhelmed. I mean, for me, it was hearing the Immigrant Song. You know, I bought a copy of 3 from a shop in Blackheath. Sorry, not Blackheath. It was Bexley Heath, called LPs. Great name, of course. And I took it home, largely because of the sleeve. I make no bones about that. And obviously, it had been out for a number of years. But I put that track one, side one on. And I literally just remember turning around going, what is this?
Yeah, and that's in and out quick, though, Immigrant Song, isn't
it? Absolutely, you know? But it is so vicious. And I was like, you know, I mean, I mean, if you ask my mum now, she'll tell you she remembers the moment exactly. Because I remember turning around going, Mum, I don't know what this is. And she turned around, she goes, son, we used to call this underground music. She didn't sound like a man, I hasten to add. but she still doesn't. But Dave, what about you?
I think, like Mark, it was Top of the Pops. And I was familiar with the music, my older brothers would play it. But I was more sort of drawn to the album covers because probably...
Oh, you've always been a visual guy.
I've been
a
visual guy.
Yeah, yeah.
But actually, over the years of working with people who'd seen Zeppelin and talking about them live and, you know, how you can't understand unless you've seen them, seeing them at the O2...
Yeah.
..was unlike anything I'd seen, any gig. And, you know, it was big and it's the O2 and it's not the first arena gig I'd been to. But the anticipation of how it was going to go, like I really felt it, like before, and then it still, my ears were ringing the day after, which doesn't normally happen at a gig anymore, and I just remember, like it took my breath away. I think that's my sort of hearing Led Zeppelin for the first, properly, it felt like that's how you should hear them.
Well, I mean, I agree with you. I thought what was stunning about the O2, I mean, two things actually. One was the incredible risk. Because everyone just went, oh, Led Zeppelin are playing, and, you know, fine, you know. So, I mean, obviously the excitement was palpable, the demands for tickets was off the scale and what have you. But for them to go out and play in that way, with really no warm-up and no nothing, it could have gone horribly wrong after all this time. So I was stunned about, you know, how it felt and how it was. But also, what I was absolutely stunned about was the intimacy of the interplay as well.
It
was
crowded around each other. Didn't
absolutely
they?
Crowding around Jason, in fact, and playing off each other in a way. I think we've forgotten that in the modern world.
Yes,
yeah.
Because we're so used to seeing bands playing, as you say, arena shows, but it's like going to watch a ginormous video.
Mm. And I think looking how they were on stage then and looking through all the pictures from day one, it's very much like that. And John Paul Jones said, you know, he wanted to almost be under the cymbals to hear, and they were very much playing off each other. And that obviously translated to vinyl as well, but it all stemmed from that, and that closeness and just playing off each other.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. I mean, Deborah, how did you feel about the O2? Because it must have been an incredibly emotional night for you.
It certainly was. I mean, you know, Jason and I are very, very close, and, you know, he's stepping into his dad's seat, you know, which if for anyone would be an incredible thing to have to do. To get it as right as Jason did, to bring that spirit, but also he brought himself, which was great. But more, I think exactly what you said, to actually go out there after all those years, I think I was in that state of, oh goodness, are they really gonna pull this off? But knowing them the way I know them, you know, it wasn't really a doubt in my head. I knew that they would bring it. And they'd bring it. What got me was the amount of panache and style they brought it with. The old Led Zeppelin, the young guys, the strutting across the stage, the fantastic phenomenon that was Led Zeppelin then, had grown, and it was something different, but it had that same power. And I thought it was beautifully done. I thought they weren't trying to pretend to be the old days. This was them now. And I thought that was fantastic, and all power to them. I was incredibly emotional. I think John would have thought it was just amazing. Me and my mom sat there, and my sister-in-law, Pat, with absolute beams on our faces. You know, it was tremendous.
It is one of those things, as you say, that the it was genuinely heroic, and actually in a moment of rare boastfulness, actually, I think the final quote in Led Zeppelin, by Led Zeppelin, is actually from Jimmy. About that night, actually, and he just says, "We were magnificent, absolutely magnificent."
Yeah,
and I think that is the best summing up, really, of that. And I think again, the textures in the sound, as you say, the material was familiar, but it was a new interpretation of that material as well.
They were just so incredibly cool for a start off. You know, they just presented themselves all these years later, and to deliver that, it was stunning.
Absolutely. Now, let's move on to, really, I suppose, our second theme of the of this episode, really, which is the fact that Led Zeppelin's music really does draw on a number of different influences. Here's another one of their famous fans discussing this. This is Mike Kerr from Royal Blood, a band to whom Jimmy Page presented the Best British Group Award at the Brits in 2015.
They weren't the only band to kind of borrow so shamelessly almost from American music, but to have such heavy blues influence but still really make it their own, I think was amazing, really, because essentially, you know, that's what they were. They were a really, really heavy blues band, and that could so easily go wrong and sound like a rip-off, you know. For moving music forward, I think that's essential, where you look at something that you love, and instead of taking it and stealing it, you kind of borrow from it, and you work out where you fit into it. And I think Zeppelin did that perfectly.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Deborah, let's come back to you and discuss the music that Led Zeppelin made, but something that you touched upon earlier when we were talking, which is really the music that John loved when he was growing up. What music shaped him, and who were the musicians that he really looked up to?
I think really the first music that really shaped him were the Beatles. My mom took him and my other brother Michael. There was only 2 years between them, but mom took them as young guys to see the Beatles live. She said it was incredible because all it was this massive screaming, but they had front row. And John just watched them, you know, with that steely sort of intent of, I'm going to do this. And of course, he ended up playing with Paul McCartney, you know. But I think the Beatles, from whenever I can remember growing up in the household, always the Beatles would go on, you know. So he really did love them. And he loved harmony and melody. He loved the Everly Brothers. He absolutely adored James Brown and all the Motown guys, you know. There was a whole lot of music. He had a real eclectic mix. But melody and soul seemed to be a real important part for him. I mean, Bee Gees as well, you know.
Right.
And Stephen Stills, big Buffalo Springfield fan, big Hendrix fan. He had a real eclectic mix. But I think what he drew on, he'd have all these melodies that he loved, but he loved the soul and the funk. And of course, his heroes in drumming were Gene Krupa and Buddy Rich. So,
yeah, of course.
You know, he'd draw on that. He used to play Gene Krupa all the time, you know, because my mom and dad were big band fans. So they had Benny Goodman playing. We had a lot of music in the house of big bands. So John really started with that, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's a trait that all four members of the band really, you know, share in a lot of ways, you know, an eclecticism in terms of the music that they loved and you know, got into, and as a result, that made up the band's sound. Mark, let's come back to you. And as a man who in 1979 was entrenched in a world of, teenage heavy metal, let's be honest.
Absolutely,
I mean, you and me both. But my question really is that what music did Led Zeppelin turn you on to? Because as you say, listening to Kashmir, you know, as a child, you suddenly go, you know, as we're discussing, it is like, what is this? This is from a different place. This isn't like dealing with the meat and potatoes music that we kind of grew up with naively. This is music from a different dimension almost. Yeah. And, of course, it leads to other things. So what did you discover as a result of Led Zeppelin as a fan?
It was from Led Zeppelin 3, because we all got into Led Zeppelin 3, which, of course, certainly completely different from 2 and 1. And the songs I loved the most on that album, I mean, other than obviously the Immigrant Song, but things like Tangerine.
Yeah.
That's the way. Yeah, Tangerine apparently is Peter Grant's favourite, one of Peter Grant's favourite Led Zeppelin songs. There you go.
It's absolutely mine.
Apparently so, for one of them anyway. But I think that acoustic stuff, it got me listening to other things. And from there, it was things like Crosby, Stills, Nash and stuff. I mean, bear in mind, this is like, we're talking 1980, 81, 79, 80, 81. This stuff wasn't hit then, you know, and you couldn't sample it, so you're in secondhand record shops, like, you know, whatever the West London equivalent was for your LPs in Bexley Heath, you know, you're digging around in the bins there and coming up with Crosby, Stills, Nash stuff. So that, it was the acoustic, funny enough, it was the acoustic stuff that I listened to. That's what Zeppelin turned me on to, which is obviously the complete opposite of what a lot of people remember them, or we all think of them because of the loud, powerful stuff, but there was so much power in that acoustic music and all that stuff on side 3 and 4 of Physical Graffiti, you know.
They were big fans of bands like Fairport Convention and things like that, so, you know, I guess a lot of that was coming through as well, so I agree with you totally on that.
Yeah, but that's what it did with me, and which is surprising thinking about it now, but that's definitely where it came from.
I genuinely think they were just a conduit to other music. That's the thing as well. Mm. You know, there's so much of that for me, that's how it was. Dave, I'm not going to ask you exactly the same question because that would be quite boring, to be honest with you. But when you were speaking to Jimmy and Robert and Jonesy about, you know, for the new book, what music reared its head as far as their recollections of the early days? You know, how did they feel about the music that they themselves drew on, and what did they discuss with you? Some of which, of course, will be in the book, but I'm sure a large swathes of it won't be.
They actually spoke a lot about everything, but we had to edit it down. But, you know, the focus was very much on the work. And for all the stories and myths and legends, when you look through the book, their workload was incredible. And I think John Paul Jones makes a comment about a day off, but it wasn't a day off because they were in the studio. They were just absorbing whatever music was around and that they'd listened to, and you can hear that. It was just all coming out, and there was no restrictions or no... Just everything was open. I think it's John Paul Jones said that everything was open and just whatever they felt like doing, and if it worked, they carried on, and if it didn't, they...
Yeah, binned it.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, Deborah, let's just come back to you and discuss how the band's... how they evolve musically as well, because obviously, you know, from you seeing them, as you say, as a sort of, you know, 8-year-old through mm-hmm. to the end of the band, I mean, they did evolve, and they worked, as David said, an incredible speed.
Yeah.
How did you view that evolution as a small child, and more significantly, how did I presume John would have discussed things with you at various times, you know, as you say, you were a tight family unit. How did he view the evolution of the band?
Really, I mean, the one thing that sticks in my mind, every time there was an acetate, you know, a new album coming out, he'd come back with the test pressings. And it would just be the sheer excitement that he would play it with, you know. From when Led Zeppelin 2 came out, he came back and he got the test pressing. And he was just so thrilled that in the middle of What Is and What Should Never Be could pan from left to right, you know, on the speakers. And he was just stood there going, just listen to this, listen to what we did, you know. With this boyish, absolute, you know, enthusiasm and just thrilled with what they'd achieved. And then later on, as I was growing up and getting into my teenage years, I spent quite a bit of time in France with him because I was speaking pretty fluent French at school. And John was out in France and said, oh, you know, do you want to come out and spend the summer holidays and you can translate for me? So it was lovely. We went out there. And it was around about the time that they'd been filming Song Remains the Same. So he got into a conversation about the whole sequences of what they were doing. So how they'd adapted a lot of the songs to for live and gone into these sequences. And again, it was that same massive enthusiasm and an incredible, he was just really in awe of what the band was achieving. And especially with Jimmy, he said to me, you know, he has the most incredible ideas and what he's doing. And he'd play again, we'd have the test pressings and he'd play it and we'd sit there. And of course, it's, you know, it's greatly moved on. They're now going into these incredible segments. It's it was just progressing all the time. And I think it, yeah, I mean, I don't think there was ever a point where we sat and went, well, that doesn't work. That just never happened. I mean, every time it came out, John would come and play it. And every time he would bring the test pressings and we'd listen. I always managed to get in there somehow to listen. I'd quietly sneak in if it was just him and my brother Michael, you know. I'd sneak in and make sure I got an earful of it. And I'm so thrilled I did because, you know, it was I was very privileged to have been part of listening to all of that in those days.
Absolutely, so. Yeah. I mean, I'm going to ask you something really unfair now. So if push comes to shove,
yeah,
what is Led Zeppelin's greatest album?
Do you know, it's an impossible, it's impossible for me to answer it because growing up with it, every time, and of course it was always vinyl, so every time the new album came out, and they were really prolific as well, you know, so they were coming fast and furiously each year. And so when the new album would come out, you'd just have these killer new songs. Now, you'd lived with, let's say, Led Zeppelin 1, which, in my opinion, you play today, and it still sounds... I mean, it blows me away, Led Zeppelin 1. I guess I do keep going back to that just for the sheer... the sound of it, you know, and the impact of Good Times, Bad Times, and the drumming. I mean, I don't think anybody was ever really doing triplets on a drum pedal like that, you know. So that album still always gets me. But, you know, living with that album and then Led Zeppelin 2 would come out. And, of course, you'd spend weeks just listening to side one, you know, before you totally knew side one inside out. Then you'd go to side two. And every single album for me had its killer tracks, you know. So, I totally agree. I loved it when they did the acoustic stuff. And that led me into listening to more Fairport Convention, to listening to Sandy Denny, especially Joni Mitchell. John was a big fan of Joni, so it led me into all that type of music. I wouldn't know. Physical Graffiti, one of the greatest albums. Led Zeppelin 4, When the Levee Breaks, and Going to California. I can't answer it.
But I think that's what's interesting, what you were saying about John as well, and about all the guys in the band. I actually think they were all fans of what they did, which is what also comes out in the book, you know. I mean, it is really...
Absolutely.
It's weird, because despite that comment of your brother saying about being flash and sort of semi-boasting, there isn't any boasting from them. But there's admiration, which is a very unique concept. I have to say, I think it's pretty impossible to sum up what Led Zeppelin achieved. That in itself is almost a conversation that could last, a few days, maybe weeks. But let's try and get another one of their famous fans to tackle that very subject. Here is a man who does indeed hail from the land of the ice and snow, or Stockholm to be precise, a city where the band were once forced to mime their way through a version of Communication Breakdown in 1969, which is quite possibly why they didn't really take to doing television particularly. This is Joey Tempest of Europe fame.
Jimmy just understood how to take it further, to have a cool band, to have cymbals, to have a great singer, to have a package, to have something that people will run to see, gather around, and it'll be like a movement, a revolution. He didn't do that on purpose, but he had it, and he dreamt it, and he did it, and that became Led Zeppelin, and we've been so lucky to share the earth with them, that's for sure.
Dave, let's come back to you about the idea of legacy in Led Zeppelin, because I suppose that is what is enshrined in the book itself. Having spoken to all three members of the band as you edited what is a visual autobiography and worked on the reissue campaigns, how do you think they each view the idea of legacy itself? Because it's a loaded word, isn't it?
If we're looking at the book, just the sheer volume of work, the amount they did in a short amount of time. I mean, I had to constantly check dates because I couldn't believe that we're 100 pages in and we're still only 6 months in.
Yeah.
You know, and they've done so much. And that really is, I know bands worked hard and sometimes two gigs a day and all that, but this is just another level. And not just working hard, but improving constantly. Everything was getting better and better and better, to the point where there isn't anyone that can touch them for live. Even after all that time and doing the O2, from everyone I spoke to who'd seen them before, who had a preconceived idea of how that O2 show might be, it was just as powerful and had moved on. And I think that's the thing that they kept doing, and they had no real interest in looking back at the time. And now I suppose it must be, whatever way they look at it, it must be quite difficult, because it's such a solid body of work in a period of time, in a very short period of time if you think about it.
I
don't know, I think maybe that's another reason why they were happy to do the book, so it would explain it for them. You can see it and you can read it.
Yeah, and I suppose, you know, on top of that, you have got the fact that, you know, the finality of the band, as it were, as you pointed out. I mean, it wasn't meant to end that way. And of course, you know, it's very painful as a result, you know. But within that sort of unbelievable ascent, you know, which they went through, which is really quite phenomenal, when you, as you say, the speed, the volume of work. Mark, I'm just going to ask you a question, really, because, you know, in writing the Peter Grant biography, clearly you were able to analyse the manner in which Led Zeppelin, during that period of time, actually changed the music industry itself, as well as, you know, creating this unbelievable body of work. Because what they did do, and what Peter did, was literally change the rule of the game.
Yeah, absolutely.
How would you, you know, describe those changes? Because, you know, we've joked about it, but they are very finite in terms of the way in which things did develop as they continued to power through, as it were.
Well, I think, first of all, taking it to America was a huge thing, because Peter and Jimmy Page had seen this with the Yardbirds, that there was a market there for them to exploit. and you know that were into the idea of album music. So they spotted that. I mean, I was shocked when you go and look at the amount of touring they did, like Dave said. And this is touring at a basic level with a van, a U-Haul truck. Nobody had a credit card. That was a massive problem for all of them when they were first out there. So they got themselves backwards and forwards, up and down the country, touring and touring. And you just see the venues get bigger and bigger as it starts to take off. It's road work, the likes of which we don't see. And then obviously comes sort of, I think it's 72, they hit them with the double whammy of the 90-10 split, which of course means that the band got 90% and the promoter got 10, and they cut out the agent. And I think that's sort of industry standard-ish now, but you can't underestimate what a huge deal that was at the time. And obviously they made a lot of enemies as a result of that, and Peter did make enemies. And, you know, after that, things did become a little difficult on the business side, because that was unprecedented. But to do that, suddenly you've got a band that's creating this fabulous music, they're selling a huge number of records, selling concert tickets, and then it's like, we own this thing. And people underestimate now that wasn't the way things were done then. You know, you suddenly brought all the power came to Led Zeppelin. And obviously Peter Grant was instrumental in doing that. Nothing without the music, of course. You can't underestimate that. But I think it was that thing that he did. He built a wall around the band. You do the music, I will take care of everything else. And it became very, very powerful. You've got this, they're almost like an army, but it gets to sort of 75 and you think, how much bigger is this going to get? You know, and you forget how absolutely huge they were at that time. And obviously it made an enormous amount of money. And, you know, with that comes greed and jealousy and people making themselves busy, wanting a piece of it. But that, you know, what he achieved on their behalf was incredible. And everything, merchandising, controlling, trying to control bootlegging. I mean, you know, it's a losing battle now with the internet. But, you know, even at that time, he had everything covered. The idea was, we control everything. We bring this to you, to the audience.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose it's the seeds of the sort of band as a brand. Not that anybody in the band ever looked at it that way.
No, they wouldn't have looked at it that way, but it was. And I think we've all talked about the album covers. I mean, this is a huge part of this as well. We were all drawn to Zeppelin because of these LP covers, because they didn't have the name on the cover. They didn't have a photograph after, I think, the first one. Or not for a while. They did in the third. But, you know, later on it starts to look mysterious, and that's a very powerful thing. And I think that was something that Peter and Jimmy Page were very quick to spot and to exploit, you know, to make the most of.
As you say, album culture is really the key there.
It
well,
is
you
the
know,
key.
The rise of album culture.
Totally. Well, yeah. Will we be played on, you know, American radio stations that play 5 or 6 minute songs? We won't do singles. Mm. All of this stuff, it made, you know, at the time, I remember hearing Led Zeppelin don't do singles. That made them immediately mysterious and interesting to me.
Of course.
And powerful.
And I think also, there's a quality control here that they didn't give anyone anything until they were happy with it. So the tapes were handed over when the band were 100% happy, and the label would be chomping at the bit, and you've got to have a picture on the cover and you've got to have your name on it. And there's correspondence you see where the label are just banging their heads against the wall because this band want to put an album out with a mysterious picture and no title. And with no release date and things like that. But it just meant that everything that came out was fantastic.
I have to be honest with you, so we could continue talking for, well, as I said, a few more days, but I think we're almost out of time. So, Deborah, I'm going to ask you one final question. And again, it's a very difficult one to answer, so I apologise in advance. But I'm going to ask you to really, as someone who saw a lot of it firsthand, how would you describe Led Zeppelin's musical legacy?
Led Zeppelin's legacy, I think to have created that body of work for a start off, and to be able to have the effect that it's had on many, many people throughout their lives, people where that music will, you know, got them through hard times or whatever it did to inspire people. And the fact that their legacy has been to inspire musicians, kids, bands, wherever, it's inspired them to pick up, you know, listening to John Bonham, they've picked up the drumsticks, listening to Jimmy Page, they've picked up a guitar, John Paul Jones bass, Robert Plant, they wanted to be Robert Plant and sing like him. I think that's an incredible legacy. It's inspired people. And for me, that will always be their legacy, the inspiration that they've created for everyone, not just within the music industry, but for everyone that hears them. They inspire.
Our thanks to Dave Brolin, Mark Blake, Deborah Bonham and Phil Alexander. You've been listening to Led Zeppelin Legacy on the Classic Album Club podcast.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.